Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you at the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM. Usually here with you Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m. Today, an extended version of the Positive Mind. The idea of today's program is to bring you information about addiction, compulsions, stuff that you have not heard before, or if you have, you probably heard it from us. We have put together some interesting perspectives that I think are going to be very helpful in looking at addictions and compulsions.
One of the reasons why we picked this topic is that so many people feel guilt-ridden and shamed and hopeless when they are affected by an addiction or someone they love is affected by an addiction. So we searched and we studied and we looked for answers or for ideas that possibly could give some hope to people.
Part of what we connected was this work that we've been doing recently on what's called the refugee syndrome. Now, the refugee syndrome is an important concept. This is something that we have studied, Roberta and I have studied and presented over the last couple of months, the response to which has been fabulous. Let's describe what that is to you.
And I think the response has been so fabulous because somehow we all identify with the plight of the refugee, even if we're not political refugees or war refugees. But the refugee syndrome, Armand, is a physiological response whereby when an individual is separated, either physically or emotionally or mentally, from his or her familiar environment, roots, his family, her family, school, group, whatever is familiar to that individual, when that's lost, what we have is a change in the physiology of the body of that person, and we went over some of the symptoms that may pop up, and we described them.
Remember, let's get this again. When you perceive that you are no longer connected to your roots, your environment,
Your family
of origin,
your group, or it could be a mental separation too. You may feel disconnected from the people you love the most.
Now, the first studies of this came, of course, from wartime people whose homes have been bombed, and they're walking the streets and they don't know which way to go, and that they have this refugee syndrome. We've also had it with many organisms in life, animals, fish, plants.
We've even looked at plants that get cut off from their roots and have similar physiological responses as animals.
So when we say physiological response, we mean the mind says the following: I ain't got no family no more.
I'm alone.
I am alone, or I perceive that I'm alone, even if you're alone in a crowd. I'm alone, or I perceive that I'm alone, therefore I must do certain things.
And the brain then enacts a program, which is an emergency dynamic that sets in, that changes the structure, well, first the function, and then the structure of certain organs and systems in the body, whereby, for instance, the first thing that happens is water retention, because water being the most important element of which the body is made, if we are separated indeed from our people, and if we are alone and abandoned, what we need the most is water. We need to make sure we have enough water on us to survive that separation, hoping that it's temporary.
So there we have just a small example of what happens to our kidneys and what our kidneys do the minute that we perceive that we are separated from our family, group, place of origin. If you have a symbolic family, let's say you your home. You know, if you move from your home, you could go into a refugee syndrome. We've talked about this related to weight gain. We've talked about it in a lot of different ways. What we've discovered is that almost all compulsions which are behaviors that you repeat over and over again and seem to have no choice over, you must do, and addictions, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a compulsion, but addictions, which are things that you must have, places that you must, things that you must do, seem to be related to this refugee syndrome. And to prove it to you, we're going to go over every one of these, or as many of these, and show you how the body and mind of the primitive us has said, we're going to get through by using this mechanism, this thing. We're going to use a strategy to get through life. We perceive that addictions are strategies.
Well, the first thing that one could say about addictions is that they are a form of dependency on a chemical, on a substance, on a behavior, on a person, on a feeling, on a belief, on something external. So the dependency, Armand, when we trace it back to the refugee syndrome, what do we need to feel in order not to feel like a refugee? We need to feel that we can depend on someone and something, a location, a group of people, an environment that supports us physically, emotionally, and mentally. So an addiction, by creating this artificial dependency on something external, replicates that dynamic that in a way makes us feel secure, because if we can depend on something that is within our control to obtain, well, there we go.
Now, this may sound very intriguing to you, because we are now saying that almost all dependencies, which addictions are dependencies, come from the same root. And we're going to go into this in depth. We're going to give you some examples. And you may, of course, my friends, want to pop on your tape recorder and record our program today, but we'll also tell you how you can get a copy of it a little later. So we're going to review this again. Refugee syndrome. Any human who believes that they are alone in this world and that some part of them feels threatened with this aloneness is going to go through a strategy that's going to be dictated by a small little DNA of the brain that says survival. How do we survive? How do we survive if you lose your arms and legs? Well, you believe it or not, there's a program inside you that's going to tell you how to survive. How do you survive if you don't have your family around? There is a program.
So there is a need to depend, Armand. And the normal dependency that all human beings have is the dependency on their community, because let's face it, we're not loners, we are communal organisms. We depend on the community that we're a part of, and that's very real biologically.
So the field is set, the field is set for a dependency.
Right.
We are now looking, we're saying, well, wait a minute, we don't have this interdependency anymore.
And so that feels really threatening to the mind first, and then, of course, the reflection of that is the brain and the body. So when the mind perceives that it cannot depend on something secure and stable that is familiar to it, it sometimes creates an artificial dependency on something else, something external. And this is where addiction, and in my belief, Armand, even compulsions come in. Because they give us that feeling of being able to depend on something over which we have some control.
We are going to talk about sex addiction, love addiction, gambling. We're going to talk about shopping addiction, alcohol addiction, opiate addiction, marijuana addiction, even smoking addiction, internet addiction, religious addiction, and more dynamic things too, which we're going to be mentioning to you in a little bit. Let's start this off with looking at how the brain has decided that the best way for us to get by is to do something, right? The brain is going to say to you, oops, you're alone. Now, here's what you need to do. And the brain will look for one of two approaches, as we see it. One approach is to get you to believe through a feeling state, through a chemical, through a substance, that you are connected somehow. Connected. This feeling, which happens through opiates, through alcohol.
Well, sure, it happens through substances that mimic neurotransmitters that are secreted in the brain or the nervous system when we are truly connected. Because when you look at a baby suckling on mommy's breast, what you see is the content look caused by a chemical flow of the same neurotransmitters we get when we drink alcohol or smoke marijuana or take opiates or narcotics, whatever. So, so the chemistry is practically identical.
So the body says, the mind says, the DNA says, and the brain says, how are we going to get by? One way it says is you're going to get a substance and you're going to add it to your body and it's going to make you feel like you're connected again. Another one is we're going to do a behavior, and this behavior is going to get you to feel like you're safe again. Now, the interesting thing about these, the fascinating thing is that every one of these addictions and compulsive behaviors come direct from our survival mechanisms, from nature. Every one of them, let's take a look at it. Let's just take a look at a couple of them. Let's start off with the obvious one, food addiction, okay? What's the body saying? The body's saying, hey, refugee syndrome, we're separated from our family. How are we going to get food?
Let's eat everything in sight.
Right. Let's eat and let's keep eating. Mm. Let's shut off, let's store up food in the form of fat. Because food may not become available because we don't have a family to share our food with anymore.
And by the way, that's something we share with camels. Camels are animals that often travel the desert and store water and other nutrients in their, what's the name, Armand? Humps. And so we share that with them. We share this also with polar bears. Polar bears, when it's wintertime, no, when it's summertime and it becomes towards the end of the summer, they know they're going to be separated from their source of food and from other members, other polar bears. So what do? They store up food in the form of fat. And people who suffer from obesity are described as having the polar bear metabolism, meaning that they hoard energy and they don't use it. They just store it.
And many of you who have tried consistently to lose weight very often will find that no matter how you diet, your body just takes the food on. This we're calling the refugee syndrome, and we're showing the connection to it. It's not your fault.
You know, I'm sorry for interrupting. There's an interesting form of food behavior addiction, which is anorexia, Armand. How does that make sense in light of what we just said?
So now here's an interesting thing. One form of addiction, believe it or not, around food is anorexia. Anorexia is the inability to eat, the starving yourself that many young people go through to seem supposedly because they completely reject fat in their mind. Well, biologically, that doesn't make any sense. If you're in a refugee syndrome, why would you be starving yourself?
Well, there are two things that have to be said with anorexia. One of them is that starvation causes an increase in endorphin levels in the brain and nervous system. So by starving, one obtains the same feeling, artificial feeling, of well-being that we were describing earlier that people get from real connections. So that's number one. It's purely chemical, and it's a delusion. It's not true, but that's what the body senses, and that's what it believes to the point where the anorexic will look at herself or himself in the mirror and believe that she's overweight or he's overweight, whereas they're severely underweight. But the illusion is such that even the perception is distorted. But then there's another aspect, Armand, that I'm considering. If I am a helpless child and I'm starving and I look so thin and emaciated that it's obvious that I'm undernourished, isn't that more likely that some powerful adult or powerful individual in the community will notice and pay attention to me and perhaps give me what I really need, which is connection?
You know, I'm sure this is moving a little too fast for most of you out there, but just think about this. Think about this, which I think is brilliant, Roberta, that by emaciating yourself, by starving yourself, by hurting yourself, by bringing yourself down to skin and bones, it is one of the ways that somebody will be attracted to you to take care of you.
Dependency.
So one way that the mind says is, look, either you could eat food, but if not, the other way to do it is starve yourself and become dependent on people taking care of you because you will be so sick, even if that taking care of you means a hospital.
In fact, what happens to anorexics eventually, if it gets bad enough, is that they are force-fed. I mean, in a sense that they need someone to actually feed them. They cannot feed themselves.
And so they find a family.
They get what they're looking for.
And this is not because, it is just because the mind said, let's try this way or let's try that way. Let's look at another thing, another one. It's really fascinating because, you know, we know that the body does this. We know that women who are feeling, who have this refugee syndrome very often will do things to their bodies or things will happen to their bodies that are meant to attract a mate. Their breasts will become more swollen. They very often get the kind of infections that will kind of leave scents around.
The ovarian cysts, right?
You know, and we talked about this. We're not going to go into it much, but we do know that there is a connection between needing to attract, the desire to attract, to get somebody to take care of you. And you could do it in a negative way. Well, let's look at some of the other addictions that are so interesting when it comes related to this. Roberta, how would you see a sex addiction related to the refugee syndrome?
Oh, well, a sex addiction, of course, if I am compulsively mating, that strengthens my relations in the community, meaning that I expose myself to interaction with other members of the community of the other gender, which means hopefully I will find a mate, hopefully I will find some stability, hopefully I will get some sense of being loved and appreciated through sex. I mean, there, Armand, I think the need and the dependency is quite obvious because the body goes through this joining, physical joining with another body. In the act of reproduction, well, that should lead to reproduction, which is one of the closest encounters a human being can have. So, but it becomes addictive because the intensity of the closeness is such that the high is so high that if I suffer from the refugee syndrome, then the low is almost intolerable because by comparison, being alone is almost intolerable for someone who has such a need to join.
So now we could look at all addictions that way. The high is so satisfactory, meaning getting our needs met through the addiction, reaches us, brings us to a point where we feel okay. A is just a sense of calm that we seem to be looking for. What is that calm feeling? A calm feeling is something like being safe in this world. Now, we could look at some of the other addictions, and you're going to find that each of these addictions somehow mimics a biological survival mechanism, which is just kind of remarkable, you know, remarkable about how it sends the signal back to us that we're okay for a moment. Here's a remarkable one that you've worked with, Roberta. I want to talk about the thing about pregnancy and labor. Now, listen to this as an addiction. Have any of you ever known women who are always pregnant, who have one baby after another, and it seems cute, and you wonder why they're going to wind up with 9 children? Well, there's something we're dealing with here that's very interesting.
Again, one aspect of it, Armand, is that pregnancy and labor and delivery increase levels of endorphins in the body. So one could just say, well, perhaps the woman is looking for that feeling over and over again.
Which is that feeling of well-being that comes from endorphins, which is this hormone-like substance that makes us feel okay. It kind of mimics the opiates, you know. We all have this in us.
But then, of course, the more children you have, the more of the community you create around yourself. So, you know, 6 children, 8 children, 12 children, and there you have it. That's a small town. So if you look at it from that perspective, then you create your own connection to your own bunch of people by making these people.
Well, then wouldn't you say it almost true of almost everybody who feels a need to have a child? That very often people have children just to reestablish?
Of course, I think that it can happen that a person could choose to have a child more so to take
care of... alone, yeah.
Exactly, to take care of one's needs rather than to really want to procreate with all of the responsibility.
But what about the pregnancy and labor?
Well, like I said, that's such a high... Pregnancy and labor are so demanding on the body of a woman that in order to cope with the stress of it, the body produces much higher amount of certain hormones and neurotransmitters than in normal day-to-day routine life. So a woman who feels disconnected or alone or bored or depressed or has some of the symptoms of the refugee syndrome may engage in this behavior over and over again to mood alter through pregnancy and delivery and through having babies, just so she's always on a high. Because, I mean, obviously, going through pregnancy and then delivering a baby causes quite an upheaval in a person's life. The other part of it is that the more children a woman has, the more support she may be able to get from her mate and or from her community.
So the pregnancy itself can become addictive. It can become, it's such a high, plus you get the children, plus you get support from the family, people around you. For some people, it's the highest state of being is when they're pregnant. And people will talk about that. They'll talk about how wonderful they felt when they were pregnant, how special they were, how people used to look at them, how people saw them as in a different kind of way.
It's also a fact well known, Armand, that the more disempowered a woman is, the poorer, the more, you know, in the sense of a social status, the less resourceful a woman is, the more children she's going to have. And this is true all over the world. It's true here, and it's true in Europe, and it's true in Africa, and it's true in Asia, and it's true everywhere.
The more disempowered, therefore, the more refugee a person feels, the more likely they're going to have many children. And it's not because they can't afford birth control. It's not because it's not available. It's because this is the only thing that feels right. Armand DeMille here with Roberta Atchi. We're talking about addictions, and we're talking about it related to what we call the refugee syndrome, which is going to lead us to some unusual insights about addictions. Okay, let's look at other addictions. Now, let's look at two simple ones. Let's look at gambling. How could gambling, what makes the mind think, Roberta, that if you are a gambler, if you go out there and you bet on the horses and you buy the lottery tickets and you get all involved in gambling and picking the points on a point spread on a sports game, what could make the mind believe? What mechanism says that this is a possible way of feeling safer in the world?
I think it has to do with the thrill of the chase, Armand, which is a dynamic that comes from way back and we share with animals with actually predators, because when you look at the odds of catching a prey, the odds are against the predator, just like the odds are against the gambler. But the predator has a mechanism inside the brain that says, well, we were not able to catch the gazelle this time, so we're going to increase the odds. We're going to put more energy in the muscles. We're going to keep going until we get that gazelle. And that's the same thing a gambler does. I'm going to put more money in here. I'm going to put more money until I get the reward. So the more I lose, the more desperate I get for the reward of winning. And that's something we share with predators. In light of the refugee syndrome, it makes sense, because by insisting and being willing to lose over and over again, we get these excitatory neurotransmitters levels increased, And that gives us a feeling of being connected. Connected to what? Connected to the prey. Connected to eating. Connected to life. Connected to survival. The more I lose, the closer I am to winning. Therefore, I keep going until I do win. And that's the same dynamic as a predator in the hunt.
You know, one should keep in mind that a predator in the hunt wins, catches its prey about one out of every 10 attempts. So there is a set in our minds that says we expect that we may lose, but there's going to be a win. Now, when you win and you finally get your reward and you get your money for winning, or you win the lottery, you believe that this win, this getting the money, this reward you're going to get is going to give you family again. That you're going to be able to get all the things that you need as your creature comforts to make you feel safe again. So one could understand how gambling can become an addiction, even love addictions. I mean, it's so simple when you think about romantic love in the form of refugee syndrome. There's a part of it that feels such despair. Of course we're going to long to find one person with whom we can re-feel family or feel family or feel connected. And the feeling about it is so desperate because in romance you get so close to it, so close to having this. And then, of course, when you lose it, you not only recognize the loss of that relationship, but you feel this abject aloneness that is so deep and so profound that many people want to kill themselves. So this is Armand Miller with Roberta Epstein. We're talking about love addiction. We're talking about sex addiction. Another new addiction that's appeared, and it's very interesting to see people walking down the street, is cell phones. It is not unusual if you look around you and you notice that almost everybody is walking down the street on a phone. Here we are walking down the street alone, not connected to any of the people that are around us, and instead taking our significant connection on a phone with somebody else at some distance away. People used to go to bars, and they would hang out at bars. They would smoke cigarettes. Well, cigarette smoking has become not good, so people don't do it anymore. Hanging out at bars has its own danger to it. And it's undesirable, so people are now addicted to their cell phone use. And it's amazing because it's all over the world. If you go to Europe, you see even more cell phone use than you see here in America. It's amazing. It's like such a strong thing. And we look at it, and we look at it funny, because each one of you must have noticed that you're at the beach and there's the person next to you on a cell phone. And you're wondering, wait a minute, you're here on vacation and you've got a cell phone, or the person's in a restaurant and they're on a cell phone. Some people go to dinner and they bring their cell phones and they have dinner with somebody they're talking to while they're having dinner, but they're not sitting with anyone. They're on the phone talking to someone. And it feels satisfactory. People will actually plan their dinner evening to talk to someone on the cell phone while they have dinner. What an interesting thing. Now, we wonder about this and we say, is this compulsive behavior? Well, if you look at all around you, there are more cell phones than there used to be cigarettes. Another addiction that we look at is what happens with the internet. It's the same kind of thing. Not even going to internet porn, just the whole idea of internet, Roberta.
Well, it's very easy to connect to someone on the internet, even easier than to go out and meet someone on the street and face the possible risks and dangers of that. So through the internet, we can be connected to anyone anywhere in the world, and we can chat. We can exchange ideas. We can do all kinds of things on the internet, and it makes perfect sense. It gives us a sense of connection, and it can become an addiction because through spending hours at the computer connecting to people we've never seen and most likely will never see, we feel an artificial form of belonging to a community. And it can become addictive when the real thing is not available or for some reason not, in our circumstances, not possible.
So we have a number of things, my friends. We're talking about things that are addictions. We're talking about things that you go through. Many of them seem like it's your fault because you can't cut them down. It feels bad to you in one way or another. You wish that you could have control over it. You wish you could stop this behavior or that behavior. And what you're really fighting is not just an addiction to a substance or a behavior, but you're dealing with a primary avoidance of a major thing, which is the feeling of absolute aloneness. Which we've kind of tracked to the refugee syndrome, you know, this idea of being alone and cut off from the world, means that you're very close to death. You need to connect. And the way people connect is through a number of different addictions, which are really strategies, ways of trying to make yourself feel whole again. Is feeling connected. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, Roberta Achi. We're talking about your connection with yourself and how difficult it is to feel connected to your environment. Everybody needs to belong to something, friends. Every being, every entity, every organism on this planet needs to belong to something. So this whole idea of trying to make yourself feel belonging through a number of different things. Some things numb you, and they make you feel connected just through, you know, Freud used to say that he thought heroin addiction was returning to the womb. He thought about that, about a lot of addictions. He said in a way it made you feel connected back to your mother. There are a number of other addictions. Let's look at television addiction, TV addiction. People who put on the TV when they come home at night, they put on the TV and here is their partner, the television. Here's the voices around them. Here's the family. They love the candle after. They love hearing these voices around them so they don't feel alone. You may even have a radio addiction. You put on your radio, you know, you may even have a positive mind addiction, you know, you may actually have a positive mind addiction where you've got to hear this program because if you don't hear this program, you feel really disconnected. Well, these things are real difficult. You know, it's not just you. Think about religion and what religion does for so many people. I'm not saying whether religion is good or bad, but religion has two major purposes. Number one, it gives you the belief, real or not, that you're connected to a higher entity, a God, you know, that you and God have a deal. You know each other. And that this is what you get through religion. Religion is an amazing sense of connection. If you ever looked at a nun who is praying, or people who pray, actually, all people who are deep in prayer, they are so blissful in feeling connected to God. Well, that's one. But also, in the same process, you're in a church or you're in a temple. You're in a place where people share this belief. So now you have a community plus your connection. I mean, so what better substitute for the feeling of being alone than having a communal feeling that comes through religion? This is why religion is so popular. Religion brings you back that connection. And of course, you know, mysticism does the same thing in many ways. Any way that you find yourself even connected to the universe, the word is connected. So if people say, through my meditation, I feel connected, you know, you understand. This is the importance of it. People have addictions to meditations because they need to feel connected. Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're trying to talk about different addictions. There are many compulsive behaviors that are impossible to get away from. And impossible to get away from, or it feels like it's impossible to get away from. And the treatment of it is kind of amazing. Let's look at what the primary treatment that is the most popular treatment is for almost all addictions at this point. And by all addictions, I'm talking about sex addictions, love addictions, the ones that are recognized, drug addiction, opiates, marijuana, alcohol, gambling. The primary cure treatment nowadays is having 12-step programs. Now, here's a double whammy on a 12-step program. Number one in a 12-step program is you have a community of like-minded people. This is very important. The feeling that you have other people who share with you the same kind of strategies and the same kind of difficulties with those strategies automatically, or very often, frequently, not for everybody, makes a person feel less compulsive about their addiction. So it's been very successful for many people. Also included in the program is a suggestion that you have to accept the deity, the God, in your life. You have to stop fighting it. Once again, by accepting that, you again don't feel alone. So the program works on a couple of different levels. That's where it does work. It works for many people. It doesn't work for many other people. And later on in this program today, we're going to talk about some unique approaches other than the 12-step programs that help people deal with their addictions as well. I'm on DeMille here with Roberta Atti. So we've been going over all the different ones. Now the one thing, Roberta, that I'm really curious about, and the one next connection I want to make is, and I think this is important for people to understand, and that is dopamine and how dopamine relates to addictive process. See, now, I mean, to you and me, this is real familiar stuff. But let's talk about it for a minute.
Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that spells reward in the brain. Anytime we perform or we engage in a behavior that is successful, meaning that we experience that leads to successful connection with other people, with food, with whatever we need, that gets us to satisfy a need for survival, the brain secretes dopamine. It secretes dopamine to reward us for that behavior.
Reward of dopamine that gets reinforced over and over again, that we get this pleasant sensation, and we get dopamine from lovely conversations with people. We have dopamine is very available, but some people, searching desperately to feel connected, go for this pleasure hormone. You know, it's one of the two. We talked about endorphins. We talked about dopamine. They have a connection, you know. And so then, Roberta, you know, there's this other part about multiple addictions. People have many addictions all at once. People could have not just one, but, you know, if one doesn't work, they have two, three, or four different addictions that work. You know, they try going from one to the other. Very often people who smoke cigarettes will drink alcohol and drink coffee and put a lot of sugar in their diet. And it's like a constant attempt at trying to get that chemistry to work for what? To get us to get the feeling that we are whole. Now, the problem with this, not much of a problem. It's really kind of okay. People are always doing it. I mean, even if you're exercising and you're doing compulsive exercise, you're doing the same thing. You're trying to drive your body to a point where you can feel whole. How many people so often will through exercise try to get themselves to feel good? You know, through exercise, they will say, "Ah, I'm pumping it up," or through fasting, or through nutrition, the very same thing, or vitamin C injections, or ozone therapy, or any number of things that look very healthy, but you can't live without. I know people who can't live without their green juice. Anything becomes a way of feeling connected. So what's wrong with that? What is wrong with it? What is wrong with any of the strategies? Well, certain strategies seem to be more destructive to the body than other strategies. There are certain strategies we know for sure that, you know, the liver and the kidneys are going to suffer from the use of certain things as opposed to other things. So there are times that you want to be able to discontinue. There are times that you want to stop smoking because you just, the evidence is there. You can't breathe anymore, you know. You stop wanting to drink coffee because you realize how jumpy you get with coffee. You stop your compulsive sexuality because you realize it just gets you in trouble and it prevents you from having any kind of a meaningful relationship. There are any number of things that we do that we eventually decide are no longer effective for us. We don't want to do them anymore. Or if we did do them, we want to know if we could do them in moderation. Now, here's a problem. The current model of treating addiction is, well, there are two models. One is, we're going to teach you to do a little bit. It's called harm reduction. And the other is, we're going to teach you to do none. We're going to show you a way of doing none at all. Theme of the cure for addiction is control. It says you're going to control yourself. But now here's an interesting thing. The whole idea of being of your addictions is to prove to yourself that you have some control over something. You see, you want to have control over your mood. You want to have control over your emotions. You're not feeling good. You want to take a pill. That's you exercising control. It's saying, I'm going to be dependent on this thing, but I'm going to pick it up when I want to and put it down when I want to. I'll smoke when I feel like smoking. I'll drink when I feel like drinking. And even though it's an illusion, because eventually it takes over and it says it's going to do it when it wants you to do it, it is still the illusion that we have control. So we depend on something with which we could exercise control. We can control it, whether it's a sex addiction, which involves our participation, our willful participation, whether it's kleptomania, which involves our getting up and going out there to steal something. No matter what it is about us depending on something over which we believe we have some control. Now, with this in mind, when you think about addictions, it's not just an illusion. We do have a control. We do exercise some control when there's no control in life. You know, sometimes I think people think of suicide as something that they could do because they're controlling. They're going to control their own lives. You know, at least it's something I could do, kill myself. At least it's something I could do, make myself feel better from this misery that I feel. If I get nervous, if I feel alone, I can do something about it. If I'm an exercise junkie, I can do something about my bad moods. I'll go fill myself with endorphins. This concept of the exercise over something which we think we are controlling and our dependency on it, our need to depend on it, we got to believe it's going to be there. It's amazing when a gambler gets cut off by his bookies, and he can't place a bet. He goes crazy. He's got to believe he can exercise the control of making the bet. A heroin addict who can't have access to heroin, you know, it's wait a minute. I have control over this. I can find it. Well, it is this idea, the need to depend on something over which we have control, that I think engenders a whole bunch of other thinking. And what I'd like to do, Roberta, is I'd like you to take the next period of time and let that fruitful, beautiful mind of yours go and fetch whatever you could find inside your mind related to the current treatment programs and this whole concept. That's what I'd like to have. I'd like it. I'm going to keep quiet this time, and I'm going to let you take it because I have such respect for the way you think. So just let it flow.
Well, now that we have described the different kinds of addiction, Armand, and we have found the common denominator among them, which is the need to depend on something over which we have some control, and thereby maintain a certain sense of well-being. Perhaps what we need to look at is, what is it that's not working in the current treatment approaches that we use, or in the way we deal with addiction? Because if we look at statistics, what we see is that addictive behavior and addiction to substances and to alcohol is on the increase. Now, if we look at it from the perspective of the refugee syndrome, we could say, well, given the fact that modern people are by definition disconnected from their roots, then we could say this is an epidemic that reflects this lack of connection, this loss of home, this loss of country, this loss of family. But I want to see if we can look at addiction from a different perspective, meaning that perhaps addiction is not a disease, and I know I'm not the first one to say this, but this is what I want to explore. What could addiction be, and how could we tackle it, if not from a medical model, if not from a medical perspective? So let's look, perhaps let's start from the very beginning, which is, since addiction and all these behaviors that we just described are behaviors by which we try to deal with our emotional self, with our emotional difficulties, let's look at what emotions are, or let's look at what's the purpose of emotions? Why do we have them at all? Wouldn't life be easier without them? If we didn't have any emotions, then we certainly wouldn't have any addictions. In some way or another, anybody who is afflicted by an addiction, or who has observed someone else behaving in an addictive manner, can safely say that there is an attempt to control some overwhelming emotional state. So let's look at emotions for a moment. And let's compare emotions to waves of energy. Waves of energy that are that move through the body and that seem to originate in the mind, and that can be so intense and so overwhelming, especially when we have this feeling of being alone, you know, fear or anger or sadness are difficult when we feel supported and loved and taken care of. But when we're alone, they can truly feel overwhelming. So let's look for a moment at what emotions are. So emotions, like I said before, are waves of energy, currents. I guess we could safely say that we're talking about electricity, because in fact, when there is an intense emotion, the electrical impulses that travel through the nervous system are intensified. So we have an intensification of electrical impulses through a certain neuronal pathway. Why do we have emotions? Well, because if we attach an emotion to an experience, that experience is much more likely to be remembered down the road than if we don't have any emotion attached to it. So when we grow up, when we're children, and something happens to us that is life-threatening, we experience fear. And that fear is such an emotional intensity, intense experience, that we're not likely to forget that experience, because it gets stored in the brain much more easily when it is attached to that emotion. So, growing up, our nervous system responds to our environment, responds to what happens, responds to other people around us, responds to the experiences that we encounter. And through emotional response to those experiences, to those people, we form a map, which becomes the brain that we have, that has learned certain things. And because it has learned certain things from those experiences, it now has a map for the possibility of encountering those experiences again. So whatever we learn, and especially if we look at the refugee syndrome, there is a learning experience there that becomes a part of the permanent map in the nervous system. And so the brain recognizes anything that resembles that experience as part of that experience, and through the same emotional response, it intensifies, it makes that experience even more real. So every time, if we've been abandoned, every time we are in a situation where we perceive that we're being abandoned again, our belief that we are going to be abandoned over and over again is reinforced. So what I'm trying to say is that through emotional response to events that occur, our brain map becomes the guideline, the landmark, the way in which we interpret life. Much of what we're exposed to day to day is therefore interpreted through that lens. And when we look at addiction, what we're confronted with is a brain map of a person whose emotional response has at some point included a behavior or the intake of a substance that has become imprinted in the memory as a positive experience, as an experience that enhances survival. Why? Because as we said earlier, when we secrete certain chemicals or when the chemicals are introduced from the outside, the brain remembers. What does it remember? It remembers a good feeling. Well, to the brain, the good feeling means unsurviving. That emotional response, the well-being, the relief, the satisfaction, the bliss, the ecstasy, it's such a powerful, rewarding memory that the brain cannot easily forget. And in times of stress, in times of imbalance, it will seek that experience again to ensure survival. Now, not everyone comes across the opportunity of smoking marijuana or snorting cocaine or drinking alcohol, or at least not often enough, or not enough need that it becomes a repetitive behavior. But for some people, it does become a repetitive behavior, and those are circumstances. Maybe someone is ill as a child and they need a lot of medication, and somehow they're exposed to being alone in a hospital bed and being medicated with a painkiller over and over again. Well, that brain is going to remember that experience and is going to attach an emotion to that experience that that person is not likely to forget. But what I am saying is that this isn't equal to saying that there is an addictive personality dictated by genes, you know, genetic inheritance or some other biological uniqueness. Current approach to addiction says there are certain people who have an addictive personality. We think it could be genetic, but it could also be just predisposition that we cannot explain as of yet. But this is a separate group of people, a very small minority, who sooner or later has a greater odd to become addicted to something. And in fact, often when we speak to addicts or alcoholics or people who have this belief about themselves, they will say this of themselves: I have an addictive personality. I get addicted to everything. Well, this is what I'm questioning. I'm questioning it because once a person believes that about oneself, then whether the addiction is to a destructive behavior or to a toxic substance or to a benevolent organization, the same dynamic remains in place. And that dynamic is the dynamic of dependency. Now, let's go back to the emotions. Let's go back to what the brain does as it interprets life. I was talking about this map that is formed in the nerves, in the neuronal connections, in the brain, in the brain response to experience. There is a map that is formed that not only affects response, but also affects perception. So that the same experience interpreted by a person who feels loved, supported, and connected, the same experience could be perceived very differently by someone who has been disconnected, alone, and separated. And so the difference is not so much in the fact that one is an addict and the other one isn't. The difference is in the belief system of the first person versus the second person. And what I'm asking is, if a person has encountered drugs as a possible way to cope with life, does that mean that given the opportunity to engage in life in a way that's satisfactory, this person would opt for what is more constructive and health supportive rather than revert back to the same behavior? But if this belief is established, the belief that I am an addict, always an alcoholic, and always therefore dependent either on the substance or a higher entity or a group, then I wonder if that belief is going to somehow undermine the growth and the relationship with life that can develop when one becomes truly independent and truly self-sufficient, not so much in the sense that one can survive alone, but in the sense that one has inner resources that allow a person to cope with whatever life can throw at him or her.
Well, yes, yes, yes. We see here's the difficulty. And the difficulty is how we see it, how we see ourselves. It's just what you're saying. The combination of emotions, control, dependency, the perception that people who are addicted are sick is what seems to be impairing most of the change that people would be looking for. This is very interesting stuff. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. And I think so much more fascinating since Roberta and I have been working on this refugee syndrome, what insight it's given us into how we could deal with this. Better, more efficiently, more understanding, and more love. Almost every addiction choice of this aberrant behavior is a desire to avoid, as we said before, this intense feeling of despair that comes with being alone, that comes with what we call the refugee syndrome. If you want more about the refugee syndrome, my friends, there's a 4-CD set, 4-tape or CD set that Roberta and I have recorded that go into it really in depth, which you can get by calling my office 212-757-4488.